In July 2008, Aaron Swartz posted a manifesto online. Here's some of what it said. Information is power. But like all power, there are those who want to keep it for themselves. The world's entire scientific and cultural heritage, published over centuries in books and journals, is increasingly being digitized and locked up by a handful of private corporations. We need to take information wherever it is stored, make our copies, and share them with the world. We need to fight for guerrilla open access. Those are the words of Aaron Swartz. The news that he took his own life last week sparked expressions of solidarity from those who support the open access movement, which, among other things, demands that publicly funded research be made publicly available. Academics across the world paid tribute to him by posting PDFs of their copyrighted works online. And on Twitter, the hashtag PDFTribute triggered an open and thoughtful debate on copyright, academic work, and access. And that's what we're going to have right now, a conversation about all that. And joining us to talk about these issues and the rise of the open access movement is Stanford University Professor John Walensky. He's the founder of the Public Knowledge Project, a nonprofit research initiative devoted to making the results of publicly funded research freely available. He's also the author of Access Principle, The Case for Open Access to Research and Scholarship. And welcome, John Walensky. Great to have you.
Thank you, Anthony. I'm pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. And also with us is Bryn Geffert. He's chief librarian at Amherst College, which is launching its own open access initiative, which we're going to ask him about. And Bryn Geffert, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And let me ask you, I'm going to start with you, John Walensky. Break it down for us. Aaron Swartz was certainly a powerful voice within the open access movement, but put it more broadly, what are proponents calling for precisely?
What we're asking for is that the research that is done in universities become much more of a public resource, that the financing of that research by the government and by taxpayers should result in research that is publicly available. And currently, the subscription models and the traditions of print are confining that access to libraries. And we think the same money can be invested in making that work publicly available and continuing to publish it with the same quality.
I see. So sort of lay out for us how the sort of academic publishing industry works. How profitable is it, and what kind of constraints does it put on access to the information that they're holding on to?
Well, the first thing to say is that it is profitable, that scholarly societies and commercial publishers do quite well by publishing academic research, largely because they don't pay for the content. They are given the articles by authors who are seeking the peer review and seeking publication. The authors also and academics generally serve as reviewers at no cost to the publishers. Certainly the publishers provide value in copy editing and the way that the articles are laid out and distributed. But the industry is essentially a service in terms of the peer review and the publishing process that enables us to provide a quality control and enables us to achieve a global distribution. And at this point, with the technology that we have, we're not achieving that full global distribution that we could.
Listeners, we're talking today about academic publishing and the rise of the open access movement. We're having this conversation in the wake of the death of Aaron Swartz. We'd like to hear from you. Are you frustrated by the high cost of accessing scholarly articles in journals, or do you believe that academic publishers play a valuable role in helping to drive science forward? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also post a comment on Facebook or Twitter at Radio Boston. And Bryn Geffert, let me come to you. I want to ask you similar questions, but first of all, I understand that Amherst College has launched its own open access initiative. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we've not yet launched it, but we've announced our intent to do so. And what we hope to accomplish is to establish an academic press under the auspices of the library that will publish material, books, exclusively under an open access model. So we would adhere to all of the standards of academic publishing, namely peer review, sending out manuscripts under consideration to experts in the field, asking them to weigh in, heavy, good conscientious editing. But then rather than selling that material, post it online, making it freely available so that anybody in the world, without regard to location or affluence, has access to it. Mm. We want to demonstrate that good scholarship can be freely available.
And I want to ask you a sort of similar question that I asked Professor Walensky, and that is, I know you're an experienced librarian. You previously headed up the library at West Point, and I want to ask you, tell us about the relationship between universities, researchers, and publishers, and how costly is this relationship to libraries across the world?
Sure. Well, librarians and libraries increasingly believe that the current model of publishing is ineffective at best and perverse at worst. And perhaps it's useful to think of it like this. If you imagine how a publication comes into being, you think about all of the research that went into that publication and you ask, who's funding that? The academic institutions are funding it. We're paying the salaries of the researchers. We're paying for their academic support. We're paying for their research travel. Taxpayers are also funding that. If that researcher has a grant from the NIH or another federal institution, taxpayer money is going to that researcher. When the researcher writes up the results of her research, she then sends it to a publisher. That publisher farms it out to academic reviewers who pass judgment on it, again, without any compensation, and then the publisher may publish it. So at this point, we have given a free copy to the publisher. The publisher has relied on other people working for free to put it together. And then the publisher sells it back to us. We give it to the publisher for free. We buy it back. It's a crazy model, we believe, and we have to figure out a way to make freely available what we are producing ourselves.
Mm. Well, I want to talk about what that new model might look like. But John Walensky, I mean, isn't there, critics on the other side of this will say that publishers still have costs because they still need strongly skilled editors to cull and verify research. They have to do all that. Here's a paragraph from a piece written by Alexander Brown. He's manager of corporate communications at Springer Science and Business Media, which he wrote for The Guardian. He wrote, "For starters, the need for strong, skilled editors remains to ensure that the research can be universally understood, to recognize emerging fields and create new journals, and to build and maintain the brands and reputations of the journals. The recruitment and management of editorial review boards and the coordination of peer review to ensure the integrity of the scholarly record." On and on and on. You get the point there. What's your response to that? That there are real costs associated with this kind of publishing.
There are real costs and there are real profits. I mean, the profits for the major commercial publishers like Springer and Elsevier are running in the area of 30%, which in the publishing industry is very high. But even leaving aside all of that kind of the technicalities of the economics, I would say that the current estimates are about $8 to $10 billion are being invested by libraries and other organizations in scholarly publishing at this point. And given what we just heard, it seems clear to me that we could spend that $8 to $10 billion and have open access. So whatever the real costs are in publishing, the issue for us is that the subscription model is working against our interests as scholars. It's working against the interests of the libraries in terms of serving their communities, and that we need to go through a major transition. I'm not suggesting it's easy, but I think what Aaron, above all, stood for was the principles. And what I would say, not a radical guerrilla value so much, but is traditional values around the opening of science and the freedom of knowledge. And the question here is not that knowledge needs to be free, it's that it's already paid for.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Aaron Swartz, I wanted to play a cut from him just because it's sort of his spirit that is sort of animating this conversation in many ways. Here he is speaking at a conference in May last year. Let's listen.
There are a lot of people, a lot of powerful people, who want to clamp down on the internet. And to be honest, there aren't a whole lot who have a vested interest in protecting it from all of that. If we start seeing it as someone else's responsibility to do this work, and it's our job just to go home and pop some popcorn and curl up on the couch to watch Transformers, well then next time, they might just win. Let's not let that happen.
So that's Aaron Swartz speaking last May. What would this new model look like? And let me ask you both that question. I'll start with you, John Walensky. I mean, what's the sort of workable new model that we should be working toward?
I think it's happening on many fronts. I don't think it's a single model yet that's appeared. I mean, I would point to things like the open access policies that have been adopted at Harvard and MIT and at Stanford's Graduate School of Education, where the faculty members are now committed to making a copy of their work freely available. I would look at PLOS One, the Public Library of Science, a journal that publishes everything immediately open access, and has proven that it can do it with great quality in terms of the ranking of journals. I would look at authors who are not just in the PDF Tribute where they posted papers, but many authors are making a point of finding a way of making sure their work is freely available. So it is happening, and again, it's hard to predict what the exact form this will take, but it's happening on many fronts. And I think the example at Amherst is one to be admired, that it takes a bit of a risk in terms of publishing in a new model, such as an open access monograph publishing outfit. And I think that we can see, and again, Aaron articulated in a way that was incredibly forceful. His act against JSTOR was a very symbolic one, and certainly questionable on some grounds, but it was an important element in terms of raising the consciousness that we need to increase our expectations, that this knowledge should be freely available, and we need to look for ways of doing that.
Mm. Bryn Gefford, I want to bring you into this conversation, bring you back in here. You wrote a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education in 2011 where you said, "Major players in the world of commercial scholarly publishing have little shame." What were you referring to there? What did you mean by that?
We are very concerned about the amount of scholarship that is being published by commercial publishers. The percentage of publications by commercial publishers has increased over the years. Material that used to go to nonprofits is going increasingly to commercial publishers. And commercial publishers, on average, charge a great deal more than nonprofit publishers. And some of them really have very poor standards. Very little, if any, editing, be that content editing or copy editing, and are increasingly trying to sell libraries publications that are, for lack of a better word, pretty suspect, if not garbage. So we find ourselves paying more for less, more for poorer quality.
Well, let's bring some listeners into this conversation. Listeners, we have been talking about academic publishing and the rise of the open access movement. You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. And let's go to Stan, who's calling from Spencer. Hi, Stan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. So my recent experience in using a university library as a holder of a state library card was I went to look for some technical literature, thinking I could check a book out and study it at home. And I found that the books, many of them I was interested in, were licensed digital copies. And I was told that I could not access the content without being an enrolled student. And I was rather shocked to have this idea now that as we move into the digital content, it's a software model. And if you're not a subscriber to a license, will you face a situation where you can't get a book out of a library?
John Walensky, what do you say to Stan about that concern?
I can appreciate the disappointment around that. It could be even more available, and yet it's more restricted. And Aaron spoke directly to that in the comment we just heard. And I think, again, it's a matter of changing people's expectations. It's not an effort to deny the publishers the revenue. It is to negotiate terms for that revenue that require that members of the library or community or the state who support that library have access. And I think it falls to the libraries, and they have done an excellent job. Libraries have done an excellent job of negotiating walk-in rights, so that many libraries have a terminal where the public who walks in has that access. But it is a battle on right after right that we have to continue.
Bryn, do you want to chime in there?
Yes, the caller makes a very important point, and publishers often constrain us. They force us to sign contracts that limit the access we can provide to people not affiliated with our institution. Let me make this point. The Amherst College Library spends around $2.4 million a year on publications. That works out to about $1,400 per student. That's a great deal of material, but it's only available to about the 1,800 students at Amherst College. Libraries see themselves as serving a public and a public good. were quite troubled that we are restricted to sharing our wares with such a small audience. We believe we serve a global constituency, and we have to find ways to make material available not only to the people living in the shadow of our libraries, but to the network of people all around the world who need access to this material. And we're failing rather spectacularly at doing that.
I want to read you both. We got a posting on Facebook from Nora McManus Vincent. She writes, as a special education teacher in New York City schools, I often found it frustrating that I did not have access to the most recent research in education. On a teacher's salary, it is difficult to afford a subscription to a scholarly journal. If teachers don't have access to this information, what is the purpose of research? I think that sort of puts the problem front and center, expresses it pretty well, don't you think, John Walensky?
Yes, that's a very poignant statement. And I can say that we've been looking at the commercial publishers, but I am a member of the American Educational Research Association, and we have published 6 journals, we have 26,000 members, and we do see ourselves serving teachers. And we are moving forward at this point to creating a large open access journal where our material can appear and be shared with the public. Mm. So it is, again, another example that this has to be continued on many fronts and that we need to continue to listen to the voices and what I would call the rising expectations of the public around this access.
Let's get a couple more calls into this conversation. John is calling from Hyde Park. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think that this issue definitely illustrates a fallacy that's growing in today's society, that because there's so much information around us and it's so easy to access, that it's all free. It's quickly discounted that people had to do work to access this information and tabulate it and, you know, figure it out. So I just wanted to bring that up, and I'll take my comments online. Thank you.
All right. So, but John, before we lose you, are you suggesting that it shouldn't be free? I mean, the idea that someone has to work to make these, to write these papers?
Well, absolutely. I mean, somebody takes time out of their day, you know, whether they have a day job or that is their job, and it takes a lot of time to find the information, even if all you're doing is taking information that people already have and putting it into a different context. It's a lot of work just to do that.
Sure.
And today, with everything on the internet, people think it's just there.
John Walensky, do you want to respond to John?
Yeah, I think that's a point that we do need to keep in mind. And I said before that the knowledge isn't free, and we're not expecting it to be. It's a matter of how the investment in that knowledge is utilized by the public and is turned into a greater public good. So I think it's a matter of reassuring people that we're not taking the money away that's been currently invested in the quality of that knowledge, but that we want to ensure that the investment increases the public good and the availability of that knowledge.
Interesting. Let's go to Jeff, who's calling from the Longwood area in Brookline. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to do it. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to say that I feel that publishers under the current traditional system do serve a very important role, in that they function as a sort of brand for the articles they contain in their journals. For researchers in the field, they can use, say, Nature or Cell as a shortcut to ensure that the articles contained there are high quality. And I wonder if we move toward more open access, more open publishing, what your guest sees as the way that we can sort of stratify quality moving forward.
Sure. Great question. Let me come to you, Bryn Gefford, first of all.
Yeah, the caller makes a very good point. The journals he cites, Nature and Cell, are some of the top journals in their fields, and they have a very important brand and serve an important function in adjudicating what is of high quality and what is not of high quality. So the burden on the open access movement is to demonstrate that it can produce freely available literature of the same quality, and it is beginning to do that. There are now some open access publications that are every bit as good and are establishing brands every bit as strong as some of the very highly priced journals like Nature and Cell. The PLOS One, PLOS Medicine, PLOS Biology, all open access journals are now regularly cited in the New York Times and other sources as publishing groundbreaking research. So I think the movement is establishing that it can be done.
John Walensky, are you in agreement?
Yeah, no, I think the publishers are in agreement. Nature has an open access journal called Scientific Reports and is looking for ways to increase its revenue through open access by charging the authors that for articles that are accepted for publication and shifting the costs to the authors. And the money comes out of their grants or out of their institution, and the article is paid for and is immediately published in an open access model. So I think we will see the major publishers, I haven't heard anything from Cell, but certainly Nature and Science as well as looking into this, are looking at ways of shifting the financial responsibilities to the institutions. This poses a challenge, and I think it's going to be an interesting one, Bryn, for the libraries. But it means that the work will be available.
Well, I want to thank you. It's a fascinating conversation. There's a lot. We could have gone on a lot longer. I'm very grateful to both of you for coming in. John Walensky, a Stanford University professor and the founder of the nonprofit Public Knowledge Project. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Anthony. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
And Bryn Gefford is the chief librarian at Amherst College in Massachusetts. Bryn Gefford, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Listeners, this conversation continues at radioboston.org, so you can post your comments and questions there. And stay with us. Coming up, there's more program ahead. We go on a musical tour of the backstreets, clubs, and concert halls of Havana, Cuba. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.